Made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Watch for season brochure and KrannertCenter.com announcements of the center's 2005-2006 season of guest artists by May 10th. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Seaboat, with a southern style of cooking catfish, chicken, and shrimp, featuring the Seaboat sandwich, two pieces of fish on a wheat bun with lettuce, tomato, and tartar sauce, and desserts like sweet potato pie. The Seaboat at Bradley and Market in Champaign. Delivery and catering services at 351-6209.
Support for AM 580 also comes from our listeners. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Listeners make up the single largest portion of our financial support, and having a large membership is important to the financial future of this station, especially as the budget situation in terms of our university, federal, and state funding is dicey, to say the very least. Rita Schulte is our membership director. She is in Pledge Central this afternoon. Rita, we've set a goal for today. Tell us what it is and where do we stand?
Well, we set a goal to be at $70,000 by the end of today. And our latest update showed that we were at $61,049. So we have a little ways to go to get to that $70,000, but I think that we can forge ahead and possibly get as close as we can to that. Dicey is an interesting term today. That could either mean it's a gamble, or it could refer somewhat to our guest coming up on Afternoon Magazine.
Very good. We're going to talk about,
I try.
We're going to talk about cooking, and as our guest puts it, we're going to think outside the pot. We're going to talk about science in the kitchen this afternoon with our guest, but we have to take just a moment here before we welcome Robert Wolk to the program to ask for your support, listeners. If you're not yet a member of the Friends of WILL or it's time to renew, please do it today. Don't put it off. Join us with a telephone call. Make a pledge of financial support. The number to reach Pledge Central, 217-244-9455. And we have a special thank you gift for Afternoon Magazine listeners.
Yes, we do. When you call in this afternoon and make a pledge at the $100 level or above, you may request as your thank you gift the Afternoon Magazine Special Combo. Celeste and Harriet Williamson, who's the producer of Afternoon Magazine, are going to select two books from the Afternoon Magazine library and a WILL stainless steel travel mug, and they'll go your way. And, you know, you can't see the library collection that exists for Afternoon Magazine, but it's stunning. There's a lot of stuff there. And they've got some really wonderful things to choose from. So their exquisite taste in hosts and programs as hosts here will extend to the books that they select. So tell the volunteer that you'd like to get in on that with your contribution of $100 or above when you call 217-244-9455.
And tell the volunteer the kind of books that that you'd be interested in, and we will do our best to pick a couple of really great books for you, and then they'll come your way with that beautiful coffee mug, and you can take that coffee mug to work with you while you're listening at work and enjoying a cup of your favorite beverage, or in the car listening, or at home listening.
Or there on that go. Hammock. That's coming up. And it's got a lid so it won't spill when you doze off.
And there's hammock time here. Is just right ahead,
betcha.
Isn't it? Okay. 217-244-9455. 244-WILL. Or you can join us online at WILL.UIUC.edu. We'll check back with Rita later this afternoon to find out how things are going there in Pledge Central. To all of those who have joined us, have joined the Friends of WILL so far this week or renewed their membership, thank you very much. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program this afternoon, we're going to talk about cooking, and as our guest puts it, think about cooking in terms of getting outside the pot. We're going to talk about science in the kitchen today with Robert Wolk. He says kitchen science is not the mere chemistry of cooking. It demands a lot of thinking outside the pot. The sequel to his best-selling book, What Einstein Told His Cook, is just out. Among the questions it looks into, where does simmering end and boiling begin? And what's essential about an essential oil? Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. I look forward to hearing from you. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're outside the Champaign-Urbana area, dial the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. W-I-L-L. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Robert Wolk is Professor Emeritus of Chemistry at the University of Pittsburgh. He also writes a column on food for The Washington Post. He is the recipient of journalism awards from the James Beard Foundation and the American Chemical Society. His Einstein series of books includes the titles What Einstein Didn't Know, What Einstein Told His Barber, What Einstein Told His Cook, and now What Einstein Told His Cook, Too. It's the sequel. The sequel focuses on beverages, dairy and eggs, vegetables, fruits, grains, carbohydrates, seafood, meats, and herbs and spices. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Robert Wolk, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks, Celeste. Good to be with you.
I should mention that the book also contains recipes by Marlene Parrish, your wife, and you dedicate the book to her. She characterizes herself as Einstein's cook. And I'm wondering, do you like to cook?
Yes, I do. Marlene and I cook together very frequently. I always have liked to cook, and obviously I like to eat, too.
Who doesn't, right?
Yeah.
Your academic field, nuclear chemistry. How did your investigation of science in the kitchen begin?
Well, I hasten to say it has nothing to do with what people call microwaving. They say they're nuking the food. Now, that's a stretch. Yeah, my research field, when I was publishing and not perishing as a professor, was nuclear chemistry. But then I went into administration, and then because I wanted to do a lot more writing, I left academe behind, and since then I've put out these books that you mentioned, and and the column in the Washington Post, and my new career is as a writer.
Yeah, and as a journalist.
Yes. It's funny, when I was a kid, even though I was into chemistry, I always enjoyed writing and admired some of the nationally syndicated columnists. And ironically enough, now I am one, and it's fun, but one doesn't achieve one's childhood fantasies that often, and I'm very fortunate that I'm doing it now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would imagine it also allows you to do something else I imagine that you're quite good at, and that is teaching in the classroom. And I don't suppose you're doing that anymore, but I would imagine that you were a very good teacher.
Well, people have told me that, but that's what I'm doing now. I'm teaching through the printed page, and the whole trick is to take this stuff called science that everybody's afraid of and show people that it can be understood on a simple, basic level. And that also gives me a lot of pleasure because people email me after a column and say, is that all there is to it? Well, of course, in one column, that's not all there is to it. But what they mean is, gee, that's not as complicated as they expected.
Yeah. In the introduction to What Einstein Told His Cook, Too, you say, science is a sort of intellectual spice that adds depth and allure to everyday things, not the least of which is food. What would you like to say about how understanding food, cooking and eating, can add to our lives, enrich our lives?
Well, before I went on, I heard you talking with Rita about dice, and something is dicey.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting, because that's the way I look at the quandary that the food consumer is in the battlefield that I call the supermarket, or I call the supermarket a battlefield.
Yeah.
The consumer hears all of these things and reads all of these things about trans fats, saturated fats, cholesterol, carbs, and all of that stuff. And as far as the average consumer and shopper is concerned, those are just words, and they put them in two mental columns, good and bad. But by and large, people don't know what they are. And so I liken that, interesting coincidence, I liken that to a crap game in which there are no spots on the dice. And I see my job as putting the spots on the dice so the consumer knows, you know, can look at a label and judge how many of these good and bad things it has in it. There's a gap there between our hearing that such and such is bad for us, like trans fats, on the one hand, and then reading the label and trying to interpret, does this stuff contain trans fats? So I bridge that gap in my book, and that's what I try to do.
Yeah. And the labels can be hard to decipher, to decode. I especially liked your the information that you provide on the little chapter or subchapter on processed cheese. Mm-hmm. You know, you go to the dairy case and you look at, you try and, you know, you want to buy some cheese, and you pick up the package and it says processed cheese food. It's like, what the heck is that?
Yeah. Well, cheese, classically, of course, is just the coagulated protein and fat from milk or cream. And then, of course, it's processed in a million, made in a million different ways of aging and different bacteria and molds and so on. There are hundreds of kinds of cheese. Now, that is cheese as long as it contains the original amount of butter fat or milk fat in the original milk or cream. But then the food manufacturing industry gets into the act and makes all kinds of foods, some of which are, if I may say so, cheesy in the worst sense, with ever diminishing amounts of milk fat in it. And it's the fat that makes cheese makes cheese good. So the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has set up categories for all of these products in order of diminishing milk fat content. And you mentioned the bottom one, which is a processed cheese food. They don't even want it to be called cheese anymore. It's a cheese food. But then there are cheese spreads. There are intermediate varieties. So I think the consumer should read the label and see what the percentage of milk fat is, and that will tell the consumer what, you know, how closely it conforms to the classic definition of cheese.
Yeah. And when you go to the movies and have cheese sauce on your nachos, it's probably just as well it's not labeled.
Absolutely. I call that stuff orange glop. And that's all it is. It's orange and it's, who knows what's in it.
It's warm and it's melty.
Yeah, that's all.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Robert Wolk is our guest this afternoon. He is the author of the Einstein series of books, the latest, What Einstein Told His Cook, the sequel. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions about kitchen science and cooking and eating. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You begin the book with a section on beverages, and you know the Kentucky Derby is this weekend, and I thought maybe you would tell us about the mint julep and why a coating of frost forms on the outside of the glass.
Yeah, that's interesting. We have many cold beverages and soft drinks or alcoholic drinks and cocktails and so on. And we're used to the fact that water forms, liquid water forms on the outside of the glass. And we are also used to the explanation that that is water, water vapor from the atmosphere, depending on what the humidity is, condensing into liquid water under the influence of the low temperature of the outside of the glass. I hasten to say it is not water leaking through the glass, as one right. person thought. a rather young person, I might
sure.
say, and it was great that he was thinking that much. But anyway, it's condensation on the outside of the glass. But in the case of a mint julep, the water condenses on the outside of the glass or cup, and then it actually freezes, and you have a layer of frost on the outside, especially if you're drinking it out of a silver mug, or at least a metal mug, which conducts heat and cold a lot better than glass does. But traditionally, it's a silver mug, and so the coldness, let's say, from inside is conducted very well to the outside where the frost forms. But why, even if you put a Tom Collins or a very cold mm-hmm. martini or something in a silver cup, that still wouldn't happen. And the reason is it gets much colder inside of a mint julep than it does in virtually any other alcoholic drink, because it is virtually pure bourbon. And bourbon is 40% alcohol, and some of them are 45% alcohol. So there's an awful lot of alcohol in a mint julep. That's what gives them the kick and makes them rather they sneak up on you. So with all of that alcohol, it lowers the freezing point of the ice in the glass or cup, the way alcohol lowers the freezing point in your car radiator. We don't use alcohol anymore, but the principle mm-hmm. is the same. So it gets much colder because of the alcohol lowering the freezing point and hence the temperature at which the ice chooses to exist inside the glass.
Okay. So now our listeners, when they watch the Kentucky Derby this weekend and maybe provide their friends with a mint julep, well, they have something very interesting to talk about after the race.
Well, watch it with the mint juleps. There's a lot of sugar in them,
yeah,
and they trick you. So realize it's virtually pure bourbon that you're sipping.
Yeah. Robert Wolk, our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. If you'd like to talk with us this afternoon, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And I see we've got a call coming in, and I'm just going to ask Jason Croft to pick it up here in the studio, and then we'll get the listener on the air. While we're on the subject of beverages, how about something very practical here? How to get a good cup of tea and a good cup of coffee?
Well, there are similar jobs, namely extracting into hot water the chemicals you want and leaving behind the chemicals you don't want. That's a ridiculous oversimplification. And so the temperature of the water matters a lot, because mm-hmm. the hotter the water is, the more chemicals or flavors or whatever you want to call them will be dissolved out into the water, the bitter as well as the good stuff, aromatic stuff that you want. So it turns out that, of course, tea leaves and coffee beans are totally different kinds mm-hmm. of plant substances. So there's no reason to believe that you would make your beverage the same way. But tea, connoisseurs say, comes out with the best balance of good flavors and relative absence of bitterness and other things that we don't like. If you use hot water as hot as possible, and that means about 212 degrees. So in England, the Brits, who are tea nuts, even warm the pot beforehand and make sure everything's good and hot to get the maximum extraction temperature, let's say, out of the tea leaves. But for coffee, that doesn't work. If the water is too hot, an excess of bitterness comes out into the water. Now, bitter is one of the desirable components of coffee. There's no doubt about that. But depending on the bean and how it's been roasted and the variety and so on, generally, and these are just generalizations, you don't want to use water that is just still furiously boiling. Boil it and then let it cool down for a few minutes so it'll be maybe around 200 degrees instead of 212. And people who know about these things say that's the best way to brew coffee.
Yeah. Let it rest for just a little bit so it's not so furiously hot.
Right.
And tea drinkers, they're very smart, those people that are so devoted to their tea. Not only do they warm the pot, they warm the cups. And then they might put, if they take it with milk, they'll put the milk in the warm cup and then pour the hot tea into the cup, which I think is pretty clever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When Einstein told his cook the sequel, I answer the important lifelong question that everybody has wondered about: should you put the cream in the tea or coffee right away, or only when you're ready to sit down and drink it? In which case will it be hotter when you get to drinking time? Well, in the book, I reasoned it out from just the principles of how things cool down. But I also located a scientific experiment that was done by undergraduate students at a Canadian university. They actually measured the temperature as a function of time, how the cup of coffee cools down when the cream is added immediately or when the cream is added after 10 minutes. And sure enough, I'm grateful that my calculations and their experimental results fit. Yeah. The thing you should do to keep it as hot as possible is put the cream in right away and then let it sit until you're ready to drink it.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener, a caller in Indiana on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I was wondering, you mentioned bourbon and the mint julep, which took me back to an incident a long time ago when I was in graduate school. I gave a friend a shot of anhydrous ethyl alcohol, and I told him, you know, do it like the big boys do in the movies, and he did, and he coughed, and his face got red, and he teared for quite a while, and asked me, you know, what in the hell was that, and I told him, and he said, give me another one. And that brought up the idea about smoothness, and I was wondering if you could talk about what is smoothness when you're talking about whiskeys and bourbons and all that stuff, and what happens, and is it a simple chemical reaction, or is there more things going on? Then secondly, do you know anything about the history of when they measure the alcohol in drinks that, you know, basically, you know, a 200 is 100% alcohol, and I was wondering why they just didn't do 0 to 100. And what's the reasoning behind having the doubling on the percentages? Thanks
mm-hmm.
a lot.
Okay.
Well, okay, about smoothness, as your friend found out, ethyl alcohol is a chemical compound, obviously, which is very strong tasting and bitter. It actually burns some of your taste buds. I don't mean with flame or anything, but alcohol is very astringent. And there isn't any alcoholic beverage that you cannot detect this astringency and strength, let's say, or burning effect in. So pure ethyl alcohol would really be a very unpleasant experience. And since people have been making alcoholic beverages in all parts of the world for thousands of years, methods have evolved that let's say, calm down the astringency and strength of the alcohol by, well, aging them in wood. All kinds of things are done to make it smoother. And there's no single formula. Every distillery has its own secret methods of making their beverages smoother and smoother, which means less harsh. As far as proof is concerned, you're wondering why 100% alcohol in a beverage, which of course would be pure alcohol, is 200 proof. In other words, why is the percentage of alcohol doubled to get the proof? Historically, the word proof meant test, to see if the alcohol was, so to speak, up to snuff. In the old west of this country, bar habitués would test or proof the bar whiskey to see whether it was watered down. And the way they did it is pour some onto a little pile of gunpowder on the table and then try to light it with a match. And if it was 50% alcohol or so, that meant alcohol would burn. But it was less than 50% or so, the alcohol would not burn. It had been watered down. So if it burns, it's at least 50%, and that was sort of considered 100% proof that it hasn't been watered down.
Wow, that's a great story.
Yeah, that was fun when I found that out.
Yeah.
And by the way, the gunpowder serves only as a powder. It could have been done with sand or something just to absorb the alcohol.
Oh,
there was no danger of explosion.
Yeah, it sounds pretty dangerous, doesn't it?
But don't try this at home.
Right. It sounds very dangerous. I remember years ago, I don't know where it was passing through a state, maybe it was Tennessee, and they had signs along the highway, you know, the next gas station you could buy. You could buy fireworks, liquor, and gasoline. And I thought, oh, my gosh.
Separately, one.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Don't mix them. We have another listener waiting to talk with us in Champaign, a caller on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. You mentioned coffee bitterness at if it was made with higher temperature water. Now, caffeine itself is a very bitter chemical. Is it the caffeine that is making it more bitter at higher temperature, and therefore higher temperature water makes stronger coffee? Is that or more caffeine-laced coffee? Is that true, or
no?
Is it something else? Okay,
it isn't the coffee. It isn't the caffeine that's making it bitter. As you said, pure caffeine does have a bitter taste, but there's nowhere near enough of it in coffee to make a detectable bitter flavor. There are other compounds in there, other alkaloids, which are responsible for the bitterness.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. We talk with another listener in Champaign on line two. Hello.
Hello, yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Often there's stories about which developed first, historically, beer or wine. But for years, people must have been making wine and bread and so forth. They must have had some theories about microbes. Did they just make sourdough? And when and about where did distilled alcohol develop? Gracias.
That's a good question. When did people start distilling it? Of course, just to fill in your background you gave a little bit, beer is supposedly older, from Mesopotamia, something like, 4,000 years ago. But I'm sure wine was being produced by fermenting grapes in other parts of the world, perhaps at the same time. When people started distilling it in order to get a higher percentage of alcohol, I'm afraid I don't know. One would like to think it was Scotland. I just don't know. I'll have to look that up. Of course, distilling it, when you distill wine to get brandy, say, the vapors that come off as you boil them are richer in percentage of alcohol than the wine itself was. And so then when you condense those vapors, you get a liquid which was higher in alcohol than the original wine was. But the history of, I will look that up.
Okay. Maybe we'll see it online in Food 101, your column in the Washington Post.
I may, yes.
Okay. One of the recipes that you have, going back to the idea of beer, you have a recipe in here. I guess it's your wife's recipe, Marlene's recipe, Marlene Parrish's recipe, beer batter bread. So beer is a wonderful ingredient for all kinds of things, isn't it? From bread, because the caller mentioned sourdough.
Yeah, bread, beer can be very flavorful in many ways. And as I hinted before, there probably isn't a part of the world that does not have its own historical tradition of making certain kinds of beer. And there are literally thousands of kinds of beer, but they all, most of them anyway, share a few things. They're made by fermenting grain, and when grain is fermented by bacteria, the bacteria feed on the carbohydrates in the grain, starch in the grain, and they manufacture not only alcohol, but a lot of other fatty acids and so on. And those are the things that give beer its flavor, most of its flavor. But then humans have decided to improve on that, and they almost always add hops, which are the flowers of the hop plant, oddly enough. And that has been shown to give very good, slightly bitterness, but good flavor. I don't know what the beer connoisseurs, what adjective they'd put on it, but so it's a very flavorful thing, and it's, if you try to make the bread with water instead of beer, you would see a huge difference in the amount of flavor. And mm-hmm. It has a, when you do it with beer, it has a semi-fermented flavor because the beer itself had been fermented, so it tastes more like sourdough than if you were using a non-beer liquid in the dough.
Yeah. And this entry from the Foodies Fictionary, sourdough, another word for gambling losses.
Yeah, I'm afraid, Celeste, I have puns scattered through there.
That's okay. I enjoy puns.
And I make no apology for puns. They're fun.
They are.
My favorite one is soybean, Spanish for I am a bean.
Ah. Bueno.
See, people groan at these things.
Well, two in a row might be,
Yeah, okay.
Maybe it's like mint juleps, You gotta, you gotta go slow. Would it be okay if listeners wrote to me and I could send them the beer batter bread recipe?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, I'll do that. So, listeners, if you want to write me at Campbell Hall, 300 North Goodwin, I'll get the recipe out to you. It's very simple, and it just sounds really nice. It makes excellent toast, says our guest, and wonderful toasted cheese sandwiches. And it's very simple. I'll just give you the ingredients. 3 cups self-rising flour, 3 tablespoons sugar, 1 can or bottle, 12 ounces of beer, preferably not light. Get a good beer for
this. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. What is self-rising flour?
Self-rising flour is simply flour that already has the baking powder in it, period.
Okay. That's pretty simple, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Robert Wolk is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He is Professor Emeritus of Chemistry at the University of Pittsburgh. He also writes a column on food for The Washington Post. He's the recipient of journalism awards from the James Beard Foundation and the American Chemical Society. His Einstein series of books includes now 1, 2, 3, 4?
4, yes.
4. His latest is the sequel to What Einstein Told His Cook. So the sequel is What Einstein Told His Cook 2.
2. I refer to that as the fourth one in my Einstein trilogy.
Yeah. Took my Einstein brain there a moment to count them up. 1-2-3-4-3-3-3-9-4-5-5, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area if you'd like to talk with our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. Anywhere else, you can call toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. One of the many interesting subchapters, pieces of information in the book, What Einstein Told His Cook Too, was how dairies produce various types of cream. Maybe we should move back to the dairy section of the grocery store now, since we've been in spirits and wine and beer. But how do dairies produce the various types of cream? Because we have heavy cream, that's at the top, that's the whipping cream, and then you go to the least fatty of the crowd, and you've got half and half. How do they do that?
It's very similar to what we were talking about before with the cheese. It's just a matter of varying, diminishing from the heavy whipping cream, diminishing the amount of the percentage of milk fat in the liquid. That's all. And so as you go down from, I have a chart in the book. I can't remember the numbers offhand. The percentage of butter fat in heavy whipping cream, all the way down to, well, as you said,
half and half, yeah.
Half and half. They do that by centrifuging it, by putting it into what's known as a cream separator or a milk separator. And it's a centrifuge. It spins the milk around at a very high speed, and the fatty part stays toward the center of the high-speed merry-go-round, if you want to call it that, whereas the watery part goes to the outside. And then with vanes and very clever devices, they can separate it off. And then once you have the fatty part and the watery part separated, you can remix them into any degree of fat content that you want.
Yeah, and boy, they vary a lot in fat content, don't they?
They do. The numbers vary tremendously. Down at the bottom is going from cream to milk is skim milk, which is these days it's called either 2% or 1% milk. Virtually all of the fat has been removed.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Charleston, line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
A question about yeast, and I guess it's several parts, but first of all, relationship between yeast and, I'm talking about the commercial type of yeast, and salt and sugar. And then I'd also want to know if you can address the issue of wild type yeast, and I'll hang up and listen.
Have you hung up already?
Have
okay,
you?
Because I didn't understand what you said about salt and sugar, but I'll focus on the yeast. He's referring to the wild yeast. There are yeast cells floating around in the air everywhere. Many different species of yeast, some of which we like and some of which we don't like. Over the years, humans have found which yeasts to encourage for whatever, beer making or rising, leavening of breads and so on. So wild yeast is whatever happens to be floating around in your neighborhood. But certain strains have been cultivated and are grown and packaged in those little packages as the best ones for use in leavening baking bread. If you try to make something like yogurt by just allowing the wild yeasts in your neighborhood to settle on the milk or cream and ferment it, you're taking a bit of a chance because, as I said, some yeasts are healthful and some are dangerous. So it's best to use a starter, which is a culture of the one strain of yeast that we know is best for the job.
Hmm. And sugar and salt, do they play a role in, could they boost or diminish what's going on in the chemical reaction of the yeast when you go to use it?
Yeah, I see what he meant now.
Yeah.
Sugar is what the yeast feeds on. So without any sugar or starch, the yeast would not feed and produce the carbon dioxide gas that raises the bread and makes that nice sponge. Salt, on the other hand, inhibits the yeast. So too much salt in the mix, the yeast will not be able to grow enough, and you'll get very flat, disappointing shape of loaf.
Hmm. Okay. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Indiana on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
I don't know whether you remember this or not, but I called when you were on the program previously about Einstein's Kitchen, and I wonder if you couldn't answer a question, but I wonder if it provoked enough kitchen chemistry curiosity to investigate.
So you're going to shoot it at me again?
Yes.
Huh?
When you fry bacon, as it goes along, it starts to bubble.
I'm sorry, say that again.
When you fry bacon,
yes,
it will start to bubble as it cooks later on.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked you why it does that.
Well, I don't remember that, but I think I can answer it. There's water coming out of the meat, and just as when you deep fry a food, it bubbles because it's water vapor coming out of the food that you're frying. And I think that's probably the answer.
Well, I suppose that makes sense, but it does this, you know, towards the end of your cooking when it's starting to get crisper, you know, then at the beginning.
Yeah. It's, I guess, after the fat gets to be a deeper layer, I don't know. Now I'm getting into getting out of on a limb. I think I'll...
From the frying pan into the fire here.
Yes.
You know, isn't it, you know, to the listener, I would say this, you know, the idea of the water, that's very interesting because, you know, some bacon is a higher quality bacon than others. And so you, depending on the quality of the bacon, you'll get more shrinkage and you'll get more water coming off that bacon in the pan.
Yeah, different bacons are produced by different ways. With smoking and drying and nitrites and various, some of them are brined. So there isn't a standard recipe for bacon. And some of them that have been brined would have more water in them and could produce more spattering and bubbling.
Well, it doesn't spatter. It just sort of bubbles, you know, all around it. The
mm-hmm.
strip that you're frying.
It doesn't pop or anything like that.
Well, I'll say one thing it isn't. It is not the fat itself which is boiling, because the fat doesn't boil. It just gets hotter and hotter and eventually smokes and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm putting my money on water vapor as the thing that's boiling out of the fat, out of the meat.
Well, maybe it's a subject for a dissertation or something.
Okay.
Thank
well,
you.
Well, if you ever trap me for a third time, I will be prepared, I assure you.
We need to get those students in Canada.
Yes, yeah.
up to, that was amazing to take a look at the question of when should you put the cream in the coffee.
Oh, those kids did a very good scientific job. I wish I could think of the name of the university.
But. Yeah, yeah. Well, it is so fascinating, this topic, science in the kitchen. And I also want to say to the listener, the listeners, that our guest today here on the Afternoon Magazine, Robert Wolk, appeared when his... the first Einstein Told His Cookbook came out. He was on Focus 580, our morning telephone talk program. And if you're interested in hearing that interview, you can go back. You can go to our website and go to the archives. And then in the little search box, just put our guest's name in there, Wolke. And you can hear and enjoy that interview as well.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
By the way,
yeah.
it's Dawson College in Montreal, Quebec.
Okay. Our hats off to Dawson College. And Mr. Wolk, thank you very much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste, for asking me. It's been my pleasure.
What Einstein Told His Cook Too by our guest Robert Wolk is published by W.W. Norton. And it's 10 minutes before 2 o'clock. Let's go quickly to Rita Schulte in Pledge Central and find out how things are How are you shaking and baking there in Pledge Central this afternoon, Rita?
Well, there's just not a whole lot bubbling out around the phones, Celeste, and that's a little disappointing.
We got to turn up the heat here.
Yeah, we need to turn the heat up out here and get some pledges cooking on the phones. 217-244-9455 is the number to call. And to whet your appetite, perhaps we'll... give you an idea of our thank you gift this afternoon. It's the Afternoon Magazine combo. Over the years, Celeste and Harriet have developed exquisite taste in guests, I happen to think. And how bad can their taste in books be? I think that's probably just as good. At any rate, they have offered to select two books from the library here, the Afternoon Magazine Library, and a stainless steel travel mug as our way of saying thank you for a contribution at the $100 level or above. When you call in, tell the volunteer whether you like fiction or nonfiction and give us kind of a hint. We may not be able to match it up exactly, but I'm betting these ladies can find you something that you would really enjoy reading. 217-244-9455. Celeste suggested earlier that a gift membership in the Friends of WILL would make an exquisite Mother's Day gift. We'll be happy to arrange that for a contribution of $40 or more. And if you really want to honor Mom, a $150 gift can make her a day sponsor to honor her on a particular day. 217-244-9455 is the number to call.
And get in on that Afternoon Magazine combo special. No fries. No fries with this.
But no.
Two books and a mug.
And no calories.
That's right. Fat-free as well. Okay, Rita, we'll check back with you
all
later
right.
This afternoon. Rita Schulte is our membership director, and she's in Pledge Central this afternoon, and she'll be happy to go to a telephone and pick up your call this afternoon at 217-244-9455, 244-WILL. Let's find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. Some more food for thought if you want to get in now early before we get started in the closing market report and you are a fan of the agricultural programming here at the WILL radio stations, please do so. Give us a call at 217-244-9455. We've got a hard row to hoe as we head out through this pledge drive week looking for the financial support of those folks that listen to the radio station. We know maybe one out of every 10 who listens happens to give or donate to this radio station. You be that one. The number to call, 217-244-9455 this afternoon. We'll tell you more about that, of course, during the closing market report. But right now, the settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade, very quiet there at the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon. Futures narrow trading ranges across the board. In the grains floor, wheat futures may contract at 311.5 high, the low at 306.5. A settlement price there at 308.25. They were unchanged. July futures 320.75, the high, the low at 315.5, and a settlement at 317.25, down a half. And the September contract 328.5, the high, the low at 308, settled 325.75, down a quarter. And the December futures 338.5, high, low at 333.25, settlement price at 334.25. They were off one. And the March futures down one as well, 346, the high, the low at 343, settlement price at 343.5. And they were off one. In the corn pit, futures very quietly trading. There was a little bit of a gain today. That despite the cold temperatures that came across the Midwest again last night. Very cold in a large portion of our listening area, at least the upper two-thirds of Illinois and Indiana. I believe I heard Ed Kieser say yesterday or this morning, not too long ago, in fact, that there were freezing temperatures and there was probably a pretty good freeze in a portion of that area. That probably had some impact on the corn. We'll try to get with Emerson Napsiger, who's the agronomist here at the University of Illinois, to talk about that maybe tomorrow on this program. But for now, the futures in the corn pit, a penny higher today, 198, the settlement price for the May contract. The high at 199.5, the low at $1.97.5. July futures, 207.75 high, low at 205.5, a settlement at 206. They were up one. And September's 215.75, the high, the low at 213.5, settlement 214.25, up 1.25 for the day. December futures, 225.5, the high, the low at 223.5. Settled 223.75. They were up 0.75 in the March contract, a penny higher, 231.75 the settlement. The high at 233.5, the low at 231.75. Maycorn 237.5, the high, the low at 236.5, and a settlement on that low at 236.5. Once again, it was one higher. May oats, a settlement price at 134.25, up 0.25. July futures unchanged at 138.25. Now the soy complex, May beans 624.5, high for the day, the low at 617, settled $6.20. They were up 1.25, but the rest of the crew were down for the day. July futures 630, the high, the low at 622. Settlement price at 624.5, off 1. August down 1.25. 629.5, the high, the low at 22, and a settlement price at $6.24 for the August. September futures 622.5, the high, the low at 618, settled at 618.5, down 2. And the November, this year new crop harvest month for the soybeans, $6.21, the high, the low at 614, and a settlement price at $6.15. They were down 3.5 for the day. January futures, 623.5, the high, the low, and settlement price both at $6.17 for the January 2006 soybean contract, and it was off 3.5 cents for the day. May bean meal, 194 the top, the low at 190.80, settlement price at 191.30, down 110. July oil meal, rather, down 110 as well, a 190.70 settlement price there. May bean oil now, up 19 for the day, 22.69 the settlement price, high at 86, the low at 22.36. And the bean oil, July contract settled at $22.78, up 16 for the day. Now here's Celeste with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, here we go. May feeder cattle, 109.92.5 the high, 109.30 the low, 109.60 the settlement, that down 45. August, 109.52.5 the high, 108.85 the low, the settlement 109.05, down 52.5. September, 108.45 the high, 107.75 the low, the settlement 107.85, that down 70. June live cattle, 85.40 the high, 84.85 the low, 84.92.5 the final price, that down 47.5. August, 86.10 the high, 85.47.5 the low, 85.60 the settlement, that down 52.5. May lean hog, 79.50 the high, 78.60 the low, 79.42.5 the settlement, that up 80. June, 77.10 the high, 76.40 the low, the settlement 76.82.5, that up 25. July, 78.35 the high, 77.52.5 the low, the settlement 78.22.5, that up 30. August lean hogs, 75.92.5 was the settlement price today. I'm getting ahead of myself here this afternoon. The high price today for August lean hogs, 75.97.5. The low, 75.42.5. The settlement, 75.92.5, up 25. And May bellies, 83.95. The high, 82.30. The low, 83.35, the settlement, that down 57.5. The Dow is up 109 points, the S&P 500 12 higher.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, helping to create a storehouse of possibilities and products from a single seed. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Ann Freeman from Colorado Springs, Colorado writes, Dear Dr. Science, I recently fell asleep during